Welcome to SCOTUSCast. On October 9th, 2007, the Supreme Court heard oral arguments in the Stonewood Investment v. Scientific Atlantic case. In a securities law case of paramount importance, the court is asked to consider under what, if any, circumstances private investors can sue actors, whether accountants, lawyers, financial advisors, or other businesses, that allegedly participate in a scheme to violate Section 10B of the Securities Exchange Act of 1934. In this episode of SCOTUSCast, UCLA law professor Stephen Bainbridge offers his own analysis of this case. As always, the Federalist Society itself takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, UCLA law professor Stephen Bainbridge.
This is Stephen Bainbridge. I'm the William D. Warren Professor at the UCLA School of Law and a blogger at ProfessorBainbridge.com. Today I'm going to discuss the pending Supreme Court case, Stone Ridge Investment Partners versus Scientific Atlantic, which many people have called the most important securities and even business law case to come before the Supreme Court in recent years. The case potentially implicates a wide range of issues, even though the question on which the court took cert was rather narrow. Technically, the court asked the parties solely to address the question of, quote, whether this court's decision in Central Bank versus First Interstate Bank in 1994 forecloses claims for deceptive conduct under Section 10B of the Securities Exchange Act of 1934 and Rule 10B-5. Where the respondents engaged in transactions with a public corporation with no legitimate business purpose, except to inflate artificially the public corporation's financial statements, but where respondents themselves made no public statements concerning those transactions. Answering that question likely will take the court into core securities litigation policy and even basic separation of powers issues. Now, Rule 10b-5 is probably the most famous and arguably the most important of all the SEC's many rules. The central theme of the rule's history is one of repeated judicial glosses on the relatively innocuous text of the rule. As the late Justice William Rehnquist once observed, Rule 10b-5 is, quote, a judicial oak which has grown from little more than a legislative acorn. Well, in effect, as Justice Rehnquist's comment suggests, we are dealing here with a species of federal common law that's only loosely tied to the words of the statutory text. The anomalous quasi-common law status of Rule 10b-5 came to a head in 1994 when the Supreme Court decided the Central Bank case that was referred in the question on which it granted certiorari. In Central Bank, the Supreme Court held that the scope of conduct prohibited by Section 10b, and thus the Rule 10b-5, is in fact controlled by the text of the statute. Where the plain text does not resolve some aspect of the Rule 10b-5 cause of action, courts, the Supreme Court explained, must infer how the Congress, back in 1934, when the Act was adopted, would have addressed the issue if the 10b-5 cause of action had been included in the statute as an express provision. Now, the court has elsewhere, in another case called Lampf, Pelva, Lipkin, Prupus, and Pettigrew versus Gilbertson, 501 U.S. 350, the court acknowledged in that case that this inference that Central Bank requires is, quote, an awkward task. But as usual, the always eloquent Justice Scalia put it even more colorfully in his concurrence in Lampf. Justice Scalia said, quote, we are imagining here. Now, to the extent that Central Bank repudiates the notion that Rule 10b-5 has become a species of federal common law, the decision posed a significant threat to the further evolution of the rule's jurisprudence. In at least some subsequent Supreme Court decisions, however, The interpretive methodology expounded in Central Bank was essentially ignored. One is therefore left to wonder whether the strict textualist approach taken by the court in Central Bank was a one-time aberration. An initial question presented by Stone Ridge thus is whether the court will rely on the Central Bank methodology. Just as Stone Ridge is situated in the Central Bank line of cases from a methodological perspective, it is also situated in Central Bank from a doctrinal perspective. In Central Bank, the court held that there was no implied private right of action against those who aid and abet violations of Rule 10b-5. In effect, liability under Rule 10b-5 was limited to primary rather than secondary actors. Hence, some would frame the problem presented by Stone Ridge as deciding who qualifies as a primary actor. Plaintiffs in the case are shareholders of Charter Communications, which is one of the nation's largest cable television providers. They allege that Charter engaged in a pervasive and continuous fraudulent scheme intended to artificially boost the company's reported financial results by, among other things, entering into sham transactions with two equipment vendors that improperly inflated Charter's reported operating revenues and cash flow. In addition to various other parties, including Charter, plaintiffs sued the two vendors, Scientific Atlanta and Motorola. At the time in question, Charter delivered cable services through set-top boxes. Charter purchased the boxes from third parties, including the two vendor defendants here. In August 2000, although Charter had firm contracts with the vendors to purchase set-top boxes at a set price, Charter offered to pay the vendors an additional $20 per set-top box, in exchange for which the vendors would return those payments to Charter in the form of advertising fees. And the vendors agreed. Plaintiffs allege that these were sham or wash transactions with no economic substance, designed to conflate Charter's operating cash flow by some $17 million in the fourth quarter of 2000 in order to meet the revenue and operating cash flow expectations of Wall Street analysts. Charter accomplished the fraudulent accounting by improperly capitalizing the increased equipment expenses while treating the returned advertising expenses as an immediate revenue. Plaintiffs allege that the vendors entered into these sham transactions knowing that Charter intended to account for them improperly, and that analysts would rely on the inflated revenues and operating cash flow in making stock recommendations. Plaintiffs did not allege that the vendors played any role in preparing or disseminating the fraudulent financial statements and press releases through which Charter published its deceptions to analysts and investors. One way of looking at the issue is to ask whether Central Bank left any room for secondary liability, and if so, whether the vendors are secondary actors whose conduct falls into a viable category of secondary liability. Alternatively, one could ask whether the vendor's conduct constitutes a primary violation, which of course would not run afoul of Central Bank. Alternatively, one can seize upon the phrase scheme to defraud in the text of Rule 10b-5 to invoke what some call scheme liability. The Supreme Court took cert in the Stone Ridge case to resolve the circuit split on whether scheme liability claims differ substantively from the Central Bank barred claims for aiding and abetting that might have been brought against these same actors. The Eighth and Fifth Circuits have ruled that scheme liability cannot be squared with Central Bank's prohibition on aiding and abetting liability, but the Ninth Circuit has ruled that it can be squared and is permissible under limited circumstances. In anticipating how the Supreme Court might rule in the Stone Ridge case, there are two critical issues that we ought to focus on. First is the relevant legislative history. Following the Central Bank decision, the Securities and Exchange Commission went to Congress and got Congress to pass a statute that authorized the SEC and the Department of Justice to pursue, either civilly or criminally, persons who knowingly provide, quote, substantial assistance, unquote, to a person who commits a primary violation of Rule 10b-5. In doing so, Congress expressly considered and expressly decided not to confer an equivalent authority on private plaintiffs. Indeed, Congress now has twice considered, but rejected, requests to amend the securities laws so as to expressly allow private claims against secondary actors. It's difficult to see how the Supreme Court could permit scheme liability, given that legislative history. More generally, in recent years, the Supreme Court has repeatedly indicated that the whole idea of implied private rights of action is disfavored. The Court has repeatedly indicated that the decision to create a new private right of action, or to extend an existing one, properly lies with Congress, not the courts. Hence, again, it seems unlikely that the Supreme Court will recognize a theory of liability that might significantly expand the scope of liability under Rule 10b-5. How do I think the Supreme Court will come out in this case? Well, when the Supreme Court was considering whether or not to grant cert in this case, Chief Justice Roberts and Justice Breyer recused themselves from that decision. Of the seven justices that voted on the cert petition, three, Stevens, Souter, and Ginsburg, dissented in Central Bank. The seventh, Justice Alito, was not on the court when Central Bank was decided. It's generally assumed that Roberts and Breyer recused themselves because they own stock in one of the relevant players. Interestingly, Roberts recently announced that he will participate in the case on the merits, and in fact, he participated in the oral argument. He took advantage of a new tax law that allows judges to defer capital gains tax when they sell stock in order to eliminate a conflict of interest. I assume that the six justices currently on the court, who were also on the court when Central Bank was decided, will split the way they did in Central Bank. Three in favor of scheme liability, three against scheme liability. It also seems reasonably safe to assume that Chief Justice Roberts and Justice Alito will in fact oppose scheme liability, resulting in a 5-3 decision in favor of the defendants and in favor of limiting scheme liability. Reviewing the transcript of the oral argument in Stone Ridge suggests that my 5-3 prediction is likely to hold up. Justice Roberts aggressively and skeptically questioned counsel for the plaintiffs. At one point, Justice Roberts explicitly stated, quote, "We should get out of the business of expanding liability because Congress has taken over that role." Justice Alito also made it clear in his questions that he doesn't believe federal law allows investors to go after vendors, accounting firms, and others in these sort of lawsuits. In response to questions from Justice Alito, plaintiff's counsel seemed to have considerable difficulty showing that the claims here differed in any material way from the aiding and abetting claims that the Supreme Court had held in Central Bank were not proper. Based on their questions during the oral argument, it seems likely, indeed it seems almost certain, that Roberts and Alito will join Scalia, Kennedy, and Thomas to form a 5-vote majority in favor of the defendants, period. Justice Alito's questions about the difficulty in distinguishing between scheme liability and aiding and abetting liability point up the principal difficulty that I have long had with the arguments made by the plaintiffs in this case and in others, which is that the plaintiffs would essentially confine central bank to its facts. I've repeatedly pressed a number of pro-scheme liability lawyers and academics on the question of where they would draw the line between aiding and abetting liability, which central bank prohibits, and forms of secondary liability they claim central bank permits. The responses I've gotten over the years define aiding and abetting so narrowly as to limit the category of disallowed cases more or less to the facts of central bank itself. And it seems clear that Justice Alito, at least, is going to take the position that central bank broadly prohibits a wide range of secondary conduct, if not prohibiting liability for secondary conduct in the entirety. Before concluding, let me offer a few thoughts on what might happen if my predictions of a defense win in this case turn out to be false. Let's assume, for the sake of argument, that the Supreme Court upholds some form of scheme liability in the Stone Ridge case. One of the very serious consequences of that will be that scheme liability is inherently fairly difficult to define, and it's unlikely that we're going to get a clear-cut definition in this case. As such, the resulting ambiguity will impose significant pressure on risk-averse defendants to settle these cases. Hence, the settlement value of scheme liability claims will rise significantly. But there's another potential effect of a pro-plaintiff victory in Stone Ridge that has gotten relatively little attention. And that is the potential overlap between scheme liability and the Sarbanes-Oxley Act. In Section 404 of the Sarbanes-Oxley Act, Congress created a requirement that management of the company and the company's external auditor each conduct an annual assessment of the company's internal controls over financial disclosures. This has turned out to be an immensely expensive process, costing companies millions of dollars a year to comply. Well, what happens if the Supreme Court rules for the plaintiffs in the Stone Ridge case? Imagine a publicly held vendor like Motorola, or a publicly held financial advisor like some of those charged in the Enron litigation. A Supreme Court decision validating scheme liability will place renewed emphasis on the internal controls within such firms dealing with major contracts. If scheme liability is imposed, the net effect will be to bring significant pressure to bear on the Motorolas of the world to subject all sorts of outsourcing contracts to effective internal audits. In turn, because nobody will want to sign off on the accounting treatment for transactions that might push the edge of the envelope without clearing it with their auditors, there'll be even greater involvement of external auditors in the contracting process. You might say, well, so what? After all, aren't internal controls supposed to crack down on wrongdoing? Well, yes, but. Remember that Motorola didn't issue the misleading financial statements. It didn't help prepare them. We're not talking about Charter's Section 404 duties. We're talking about imposing more extensive and demanding Section 404 requirements on firms in connection with somebody else's disclosures. Today, firms seldom put internal control performance provisions in contracts with customers or suppliers. The reason is that it's bad enough trying to monitor your own internal controls. Trying to monitor somebody else's internal controls is orders of magnitude more difficult and more expensive. Yet that is exactly what will be required if the Supreme Court holds for the plaintiffs in this case. In sum, the safe bet is a 5-3 win for the defendants, both as a matter of statutory language, legislative history, and public policy. That will be the right outcome. I'm Stephen Bainbridge. You can visit my website, ProfessorBainbridge.com, for extended coverage of this fascinating and very important Supreme Court decision. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUSCast. For more episodes of SCOTUSCast, as well as audio and video from past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.